It's a collaboration between the world's oldest living culture and its newest science. And its scientific director says it's profoundly changed the way he approaches his work. Professor Simon Eastdale is the director of the National Centre for Indigenous Genomics at the Australian National University. He's been working closely with Indigenous Australians, including the Human Rights Commissioner Mick Gooder, to bring Aboriginal DNA into the global science on the human genome. Professor Eastdale is in Sydney today to give a talk at the Human Rights Commission about his work, and he joined me in the World Today studio.
Well, around the world there are large projects going on in developing the underpinnings for what's now being referred to as genomic medicine. These are large data sets of genomes that are being collected, and what we're aiming to do is to ensure that in this process, which is largely currently built around people of European ancestry in Europe and North America, is extended to include Indigenous Australians.
Is Indigenous DNA so different, though, from European DNA?
There are subtle differences all around the world. And this is particularly the case with rare genetic variation that's associated with rare diseases. It's also relevant in cancer, where you have mutations that are associated with disease. These vary from place to place. We know that that's the case. And we know that we can't develop a knowledge base that's useful to everybody that's simply based on people from Europe.
So as the director of this centre, you're asking Indigenous Australians to give their permission for you to use their DNA and that of their ancestors for research. Now, this is, of course, a highly sensitive issue given the history of white scientists taking artefacts and even the remains of Aboriginal Australians out of the country without permission. How wary are Indigenous Australians about this when you first approach them?
Well, they're justifiably extremely wary, and it goes beyond that because, of course, the genetic theories have been used in the past to justify racial discrimination. We're not just asking for permission here. We're working with Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people to develop a framework where they're in control, they're in charge, and we're embedding the expertise, the genomics, bioinformatics, and other biomedical expertise that's required to this in a framework that has Indigenous governance.
When you say they're in charge, how does that work in something so extremely specialised in science?
Well, the key to this is an Indigenous Governance Board that Mick Gooder chairs, so that all the decisions, all the policy framework, all the ethics is all controlled by the Indigenous Governance Board. And beneath that, we have a Research Advisory Committee, we have an Access Committee of Indigenous people that make decisions on the use of the data that we will be generating. We also work closely with local health organisations, cultural organisations, and with the communities, the elders and the families and the communities.
And what sort of fears are you encountering?
I wouldn't phrase them necessarily as fears, but concerns about commercial use of the material and benefit sharing. They even range into science fiction areas of cloning and so forth. Those are on the margins, I think. The real concerns are about being shown appropriate respect and being involved in deciding about what is done, how it's done, and what this is used for.
The ANU already has an extraordinary collection of Indigenous DNA that was built up in the second half of the last century. Tell us about that.
That's really where we got started. We had this collection, and it's a collection that extends beyond Australia. It's in fact, there are nearly 400,000 samples from around the world. And in amongst that, there are approximately 7,000 samples that were collected at 43 locations beginning in the 1960s and going through to the 1990s.
Isn't that quite a big selection?
It is, yes. And it across Western Australia, Northern Territory and Queensland. And we were really faced with the dilemma of what to do with this. It was appropriate to stop working on it in the 1990s and wait until we had an appropriate dialogue with Indigenous people about what to do with it. So we set up an external committee of Indigenous people and put ourselves in their hands and said, what should we do? And gave them the options, including repatriating it, throwing it out, putting it back in the freezer for the next 50 years or using it. They were very enthusiastic that this was an extremely important resource, not just scientifically, but also historically and culturally, and that it should be managed appropriately.
And all these samples that were collected in the second half of last century, you don't know whether or not consent was given, so I guess you have to presume it wasn't. How would you have felt as a scientist if the decision had been, okay, we destroy it all?
I would have been disappointed, but I would have accepted that that was the case. Now, we do assume that. There is correspondence. There were no ethics committees back then. There was no national statement for ethical research involving human subjects. There was no framework. All the indications from the field notes and the correspondence is that this was done in a respectful way. It was not a coercive process, but we really don't know. We do start from that position and we go back to people. We explain both at the community level, the family level, and the individual level, and working through organisations, as I said, that what has happened, and that we don't really know what happened back then. So we're here now to ask for your permission, either directly if people are still living or if people have passed away on behalf of their family members.
And what are the tangible benefits that the science of genomics can offer Indigenous Australians?
Our focus has been on medical and health benefits, most particularly at the moment that's relevant in, as I said before, rare diseases. There's an example last year of a family in the Western Desert, for example, where this was relevant.
Tell us about that family.
Well, the clinical geneticists involved there were trying to understand what gene and what particular variant of the gene was associated with this inherited disorder in the family, and they thought they had the answer. But because there's no reference material for that area, for the people from that area, they didn't know whether it was simply something that was common there, although it was rare elsewhere, and we know that happens around the world. But if it was causal, then it had profound implications in terms of the treatment and management of the condition, and indeed when they were finally able to confirm that, they then were able to treat the members of that family who were affected appropriately. Now, if the kind of resource that we're trying to create were available, that would have happened a year earlier with better outcomes.
And your centre's website says that this connection between the world's oldest living cultures and its newest science is transforming all of those people involved. How has it changed you?
It really has changed the way that I see this kind of work quite profoundly. And one of the most important aspects of that is we talk about the DNA having stories about people's health and about their past, and giving, in a sense, respect to that fact that we tend in the lab, and I have to say through my career, I've tended to see these as little tubes in the freezer that you take out periodically and do things to and get data and then write it up and so on. But there is, in the minds of some people we've spoken to, a really profound and almost spiritual connection to that material, in the sense that that is indeed part, either an extension of someone or part of someone, and that it needs to be respected and treated in that way.
And I understand that the samples are used obviously for scientific and medical purposes, but there are also potential cultural benefits of exploring this DNA. What are they?
There's a couple, I think, dimensions of that. We're very much hoping, and we've had indications from elders from some communities that they would like to come to Canberra and to properly acknowledge the existence of the material and see it and to be more a part of it. And there's a sense in which in some communities it's had an extraordinary effect of bringing people together to work out how to think about this, because of this connection of the material to identity and to health. It's very important. At a more practical level, there's a potential here to reconnect with family where that may have been lost, and there's been a lot of interest in that.
Well, I guess the stolen generations
Exactly. And then going further than that, the potential to identify the source of remains that were removed and taken to museums and hospitals and so on that are now being repatriated. Often the precise location or the family or the group where that came from is not known, so there's a potential there of helping to reconnect there. So there are those very practical aspects of it as well.
Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Professor Simon E. Steele. He's the director of the National Centre for Indigenous Genomics, and you can hear a longer version of that interview on our website later this afternoon.